MacCast, Monday, March 28th, 2005. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for the MacCast, a show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geek. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. All right, so news in the Macintosh world. Things are slowing down. Well, not slowing down, but just there's not a whole lot happening. I think I mentioned on the Friday show that this seems to happen every time right before Apple has a big announcement. And we all know Tiger's coming up here supposedly around the 1st of April. So things have gotten a little quiet in the Macintosh news front. So I just have a couple news stories to cover for you guys today. But what has really picked up recently is the amount of listener feedback and just dialogue going on between you and me. And I'm really enjoying it, getting lots of great email and comments and MP3 audio files and questions. And the MacCast.com website is taking off. I'm starting to do a lot more responses there, posting listener feedback there. I have the ability now to categorize my different posts. So now we have the podcasts separated from the listener feedback, separated from the news items. So we have three different categories. So if you do email me and you don't hear your a response to your question on the show, you might want to head over to MacCast.com and check out the listings there. I probably will be posting a lot more listener questions there and opening up for people to leave. There is the ability to leave comments on the website. So you can leave your comments in response to any questions somebody might have. And I figure that's maybe a better way to get a little more of the MacCast listener community involved in helping each other out. And that was one of the reasons I started this podcast, was to have it be, you know, one set of Mac geeks helping another set of Mac geeks. And in this case, for the, you know, podcast portion, it's me helping you through audio. But I want to get everybody involved, and I think it's starting to really work. It's starting to click now, and as the show becomes more and more popular, I think I'm getting very pleased with how things are going. So I thank you all for participating. Please continue to visit the website, and please continue to send your comments and things like that. So anyway, that said, let's get right into the news. Man, you guys, this is something that someone passed along to me. I hadn't even heard about it yet, or I didn't pick it up on my news feeds, but I just couldn't believe it when I saw it. And what it was Jack Campbell is a guy who runs DVForge. You guys may be familiar with Mac Mice products or DVForge products. They really do make a lot of great accessories for the Macintosh, and they've been great supporters of the Macintosh for a long time, and I really enjoy their products. But he did something, and there's a lot of debate on why he did this. I'm not really sure what his motivation was. I think he's just a really hardcore, diehard Mac fan, and he got really upset about the announcement that Symantec made, claiming that, you know, Mac users better kind of watch their backs, that viruses and spyware are going to be targeting the Mac more and more as we gain popularity with more switchers, more people using iPods and coming over to the Macintosh, and especially with the new Mac Mini gaining a lot more market share for Apple, which is great. Symantec issued this warning that, hey, you guys, there's going to be viruses coming and you better be prepared. And a lot of people feel, and I feel this way myself, that Symantec did this. I mean, they obviously have a vested interest in people being concerned about viruses and spyware on their Macs, because they're going to sell more software. So Jack took it one level further and kind of got fairly upset about it, I guess. And so he issued a press release saying that he was going to offer a $25,000 reward to the first programmer or person, hacker, whatever you want to say, to write a virus that would infect a Macintosh or a pair of Macintoshes he was going to set up in Tennessee. So basically, he was inviting people to write Macintosh viruses. So, and it was just a challenge to say, hey, I think the Macintosh is secure, and I think Symantec, you're full of it. So he was, you know, hoping that that would prove them wrong. And then I think his lawyers, Jack's lawyers, got in touch with him, and in hindsight, he pulled the contest. So now people are speculating that maybe it was just a big promotional stunt or something like that to get more exposure for DVForge and Mac Mice. But I think he's probably just a really passionate Macintosh user. for my opinion on it, I think that, you know, no operating system is completely immune. And I think, of course, someone could write a virus that would target the Macintosh or write spyware that targets the Macintosh. We, you know, have been lucky and we haven't had that happen yet because we have a smaller market share. And I'm sure that, you know, a exploit or a virus will come up. But I think because of its open source base, or its Unix base, I guess, not necessarily open source, but Darwin is open sourced, that there's a huge community that's kind of watching our back as well that Microsoft doesn't have. So when a exploit is discovered or something, it's generally patched fairly quickly on the Macintosh, and Apple issues a patch to protect ourselves. So I do think we are more secure than Windows. Are we 100% secure? No, I wouldn't say that. And I think the lawyers got to Jack and said, hey, you know, if we have we pay people to basically write a virus for the Macintosh and something happens here, we're going to be liable. So he did pull the competition, and he was even offering $50,000 to anybody at Symantec who would actually write the virus. So it was an interesting thing, or interesting challenge. I don't know if I think it was a publicity stunt. I think it was just, you know, a compassionate or a passionate Macintosh supporter kind of going over the top and then realizing, hey, maybe this was kind of a mistake. But anyway, chime in with your opinions on that. I'm sure a lot of you heard about this or read about it, and maybe you're hearing it on the MacCast for the first time, but just an interesting thing happened, and there was a lot of fallout from it. So interesting open discussion. Leave comments on the MacCast.com if you want, or just send me email or MP3 audio comments, and we'll get a little dialogue going about how we feel about, you know, people issuing challenges for hackers to write viruses for the Macintosh. I don't think it's a good thing to invite hackers. You know, I'm sure there's already people thinking about it, so they don't need any more encouragement. Okay, this next thing is kind of cool, and it kind of sticks along with our open community type show that we're kind of themed towards tonight. Listener Daryl sent me a message and said, hey, I am a new Mac user, recent switcher, and I'd love to do a little segment for you on guides or tips for new Mac users. So he put together this little audio. It's Daryl's Guide for New Mac Geeks. I hope you guys like it, and hopefully it'll become a regular segment here on the MacCast. So take a listen to the first installment of Daryl's Guide for New Mac Geeks.
It's time for Daryl's Guide for New Mac Geeks. Tips and tricks for new Mac geeks by a new Mac geek. Okay, today we have a couple of tips for those of you who use Safari. Safari does a very nice job of blocking pop-up windows. To turn the pop-up blocker on, simply click the word Safari at the top left of the screen, then scroll down to where you see Block Pop-up Window. But sometimes the pop-up window blocker can work a little too well. So if you find a site that does not seem to be working properly, try turning the pop-up blocker off. Just be sure to turn it back on when you're finished. If you're like me, you want to browse several websites at the same time. But how do you bring up a new page in Safari to browse multiple sites simultaneously? Simply hit the Command button, which is the button with the apple on it, and N. Command N will open a new window. You can open as many windows as you like, and the open windows you have that you are not currently viewing will be displayed in the bottom right-hand side of the dock. Okay, if you're looking for a way to control iTunes more easily, there is an application available called Synergy. Now, what Synergy does is installs three buttons in the menu bar, a previous track, next track, and play pause button, as well as give you visual information on the current song playing. A link for Synergy will be available in the show notes at MacCast.com. This has been Daryl's Guide for New Mac Geeks. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on the MacCast.
All right, so there you have it, Daryl's Guide for New Mac Geeks. Hopefully those find those tips handy. I did want to add one little comment about the new window or browsing multiple websites using Safari. Another great tip is to try out tabbed browsing. Safari lets you do what's called tab browsing. If you have your Safari window open and you go into your preferences in Safari and you go to the tab preference panel, you can enable tab browsing. And then once you do that, if you press Command T, it will actually open a new tab rather than a new window. So you can have one window open, but have multiple tabs, and each tab can have a different website loaded, enabling you to easily switch back and forth. So that's another great tip on Safari. And I thank Daryl for putting that together, and let me know what you guys think. If you enjoy that segment, then hopefully we can get Daryl to do some more for us, because I think he did a nice job. So I saw an interesting post on Mac Rumors today, especially if you're into gaming on your Macintosh. Apparently, there's some rumors that over on the OpenGL mailing list, Apple is looking for new developers that have OpenGL experience. And the rumor is that there was some poor performance on the Mac Doom 3 specifications in terms of its speed. And Apple may be looking to get some help in the area of Mac's OpenGL implementation and hopefully bump things up. So it sounds like Apple's maybe taking more of an active role in games on the Macintosh. So maybe that market will improve somewhat. We'll just have to wait and see. So you've heard me talk about Firefox, and I'm a Firefox user. I think the browser's really great. I really enjoy it. It's caused me to switch over from Safari. And we had some discussion a while back about Camino, and I was a little confused about what Camino was all about. Well, now Camino has a brand new project website. It's CaminoBrowser.org. You definitely going to want to go over and check that out if you're looking for alternate browsers, maybe something that's a little speedier. Camino, for those of you who don't know, is a browser that uses the Mozilla Gecko engine, so basically the same engine that Firefox is using. But what's different about it is it uses the Mac OS X native Cocoa user interface elements, so it provides a much more Mac-like experience, at least according to the people over at Camino. Camino is an absolutely great browser, good alternative to Firefox if you're maybe looking for something that's more Mac-like, and I'm definitely going to go and check it out and try and chime in the next coming weeks on my opinions about it. We have a little comment in the listener feedback section about browsers and browser performance on the Macintosh. So, you know, maybe Camino can solve some of those issues. We'll talk about that a little bit later. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm getting a lot of great feedback from listeners. And we have had this kind of ongoing discussion in the last couple shows about RAIDs on the Macintosh. And some things were said, and listener Simon pointed out one little correction that I thought was important to make. And it's probably going to end our discussion on RAIDs, at least on the show. And if we need to continue it, we'll continue it on the maccast.com website. But anyway, here's what Simon had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Simon from Hampshire in England. I've just been listening to the Maccast for the 25th of March, and I wanted to add my tuppence worth to the comments about RAIDs. And a couple of people were saying that if you're making a RAID set, the disks that you need have to be the same size. And my experience, this isn't strictly true. That one of the points about a RAID of inexpensive devices or drives is that you can use what you've got lying around. So, for example, if you've got a 20 gigabyte drive and a 30 gigabyte drive, you can put those together in a RAID. The smaller of the drives will determine the total size, and also the slowest drive will limit the speed of the RAID. But if you've got a 20 gig drive and a 30 gig drive, if you mirror them, which gives you a nice and safe RAID, that will be a 20 gigabyte RAID, because the remaining 10 gigabytes of the 30 gigabyte drive won't be used. And if you were to stripe them, then you would get a 40 gigabyte array. It's what we call dangerous mode. That's 2 times 20 gigabytes, and again, the remaining 10 gigabytes of the 30 gigabyte drive wouldn't get used. So it seems a bit wasteful, but on the other hand, if those are the drives that you've got lying around and you just want to make a safe RAID or get some slightly better disk performance, then that should do just fine. It's always preferable to use 2 drives of the same size, or 2 drives that are exactly the same make and model. That will always give you the most consistent performance. But anyway, I just wanted to add that because I think that it's a misconception that you can't use different drives. And I don't think that the Disk Utility Help contradicts that, although I must admit I haven't tried it myself. So anyway, thanks for a good show. Keep up the great work. Bye.
So thanks to Simon for giving us more education on RAIDs. I think we've learned a lot so far, or at least I've learned a lot, so hopefully you have and you've enjoyed that. Like I said, if we get any more discussion on RAIDs, we'll move it back onto the website because, man, we have just lots of more topics to cover, and I want to keep the discussion moving forward. So there's a service called Flickr for photos. Actually, I'm not super familiar with the service, but I know that a lot of people use it, and it's been in the tech news recently because Yahoo is either looking at buying or did buy Flickr. I'm not really sure, but I believe it's like a photo blogging website, and many of you are into it. So a listener, Mark, sent in a comment, and he said that he found a great little utility that is a export for iPhoto. It's a plugin for iPhoto that'll let you export your photos straight out to Flickr. So if you're interested in that, I put it link to it in the show notes. It's from a company called Spears, I believe. Let me check the link here real quick. Okay, it's not so much a company as it is a guy. It's from a guy named Fraser Spears, and it's the Flickr export plugin for iPhoto. So if you're a Flickr user and you use iPhoto for managing your photos, you may want to check that one out. Okay, also big tech news recently was the launch of the Sony PSP, the Sony PlayStation Portable. And since you are all geeks like me, I'm sure you're very interested in it. I actually got one today, picked one up, and it is awesome. Let me tell you, this thing is just so cool. It does not only portable video games, but movies, MP3s, photos, a great digital photo player. The screen on it is just beautiful. It's in a 16:9 aspect ratio, perfect for movies. But I loaded some photos on it and put some music on it, some MP3s, and it just does a beautiful job at everything. And I just can't say enough about the screen. I think that's what really puts it over the top. It's a large 480 by 272 resolution screen, and it just looks gorgeous. It's bright and colorful, and I can't say enough about it. There's been a lot of reports on the internet about quality issues with dead pixels and things like that. We saw it. I've seen it on a couple of them, but it's really a minor issue when you really look at the overall quality of the screen. So don't let that discourage you if you're thinking about getting a PSP. I think a lot of people are being overly critical of the LCDs. It's common for LCDs to have one or two dead pixels. It's not anything you can really prevent. It's just part of the manufacturing process. But anyway, I'm getting kind of off topic. I have a listener, Patrick, who does the PJK podcast, pjk.net, and he is going to be doing a rundown of the Sony PlayStation Portable and how to get movies and, I believe, photos onto it. But I'll let him tell you about it.
Hey, Adam, it's Patrick Carney, and wanted to wish you a happy Easter and also let you know that I am doing a series on my podcast and video blog on the PlayStation Portable. And I've been doing some tests. I got this device on launch and have been doing some tests with getting video over to it, as well as getting audio from podcasts and stuff over to it, and have had mixed success. The PC environment is absolutely pathetic for this PlayStation Portable, so I've had a lot of luck on the Mac, believe it or not, because Sony and Mac is, that relationship is acrimonious at best. But I wanted to share my experiences with you and your listeners, and if they wanted to subscribe, they could go to pjk.net and get some information there. But I'm using the Mac programs iPSP and PSPware, and I'm sort of putting them through the paces and seeing which one works the best, and I'm also looking for other applications as well. So if anybody has tests they want me to run, they can certainly get a hold of me at the website there, and I'll keep you posted on how it's going, and take care. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, so pjk.net if you want to get some more information on using your Sony PlayStation Portable with your Mac. Okay, so I know a lot of you have iPod Shuffles now, and some of you probably have older Macs. And this next question came from Bjorn, and it was an interesting one for me. I tried answering it the best I could, but thought maybe some of you out there would know some additional answers. Basically, he has an old iBook that only has a 1.0 USB port, and while he loves his new Shuffle, he's having a hard time with the transfer times. It takes a long time to transfer data via USB 1.0 to an iPod Shuffle. So what he was wondering is, and what I'm wondering as well, is there some sort of USB 2.0 to FireWire adapter? So He has a FireWire 400 port on that iBook, and I was just wondering, and I did some searching online. I couldn't find anything myself. Wondering if anybody made a USB 2 to FireWire box. The one thing I think that's maybe coming into play here is the fact that USB 2.0 is slightly faster than FireWire 400. So maybe there's some problems there with down converting the transfer rate or something like that from USB 2 to FireWire 400. Not really sure. But if anybody knows of a solution that'll help him transfer his files from his iPod Shuffle through USB 1.0 or FireWire, I guess would be the way to go, faster, he'd appreciate it. And I'd love to pass those answers on to him and plus educate myself, I guess, at the same time. So I listen to all my podcasts pretty much on my iPod. Occasionally I'll listen at work through iTunes, but I'm usually right next to my computer. I know that some people as well are also listening via iTunes, and Seth is one of those people. He had an interesting question, and he was hoping someone could help him out with it.
Hello, Adam. My name is Seth, and I am a PC user, but I use iTunes to manage all my music, and I listen to all my music through iTunes, and I listen to a lot of podcasts, but I listen to them in, I guess, a traditional radio fashion where I sit back and relax and listen to the show, but I'm wondering if there's a way that I could display the song information and elapsed time in a bigger font. So basically when I'm sitting, let's say, 10 or 15 feet away from the monitor, I'd still be able to see how much time has gone by, and you know, just the general information that's displayed by iTunes. I just can't see it when I'm sitting far away. If you know if there's a settings preference that I could change to do that, or if there's another program or extension out there that allow me to do this, that would be great. Thanks.
So, okay, you get it. Seth's sitting at his PC. He's about 15, 20 feet away, and he wants to just be able to see the track information, what's playing, and how much time has gone by or how much time has elapsed since he started playing it. And right off the bat, I couldn't think of anything. There's obviously not any settings directly in iTunes, and he's on a PC, which makes it a little more tricky for me to figure out, being pretty much a Mac person. But what I came up with was maybe that there was a visualizer. If you guys are familiar with iTunes, you know that there is the visualizer, which in most cases plays some sort of patterns or things like that while you're playing music, just as a kind of a eye candy or a visual tool for viewing your music as it's playing. But there's a lot of great visualizers out there, and I found just an awesome one. Unfortunately, it only works on the Macintosh, but it kind of does exactly what Seth wants to do. The one I found is called Jewel Case, and it's from Optical Alchemy. It's opticalalchemy.com. There's a link from the show notes. And what this thing does is it actually takes your album art and all the track information for the album, assembles it all together in sort of an OpenGL format, and displays a rotating CD jewel case. So you have the album art on the front and then all the track information on the back, and then to the left of that it shows the album information, and then down in the lower right corner in large font, it shows the elapsed time. So it does everything Seth wants. Unfortunately, it doesn't work on the Macintosh, or on the PC, only the Macintosh. So if anybody knows of something like this for the PC, or knows something that will solve Seth's problem, then please send me an email and let me know about it. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure Seth would also. So I guess because I'm in podcasting, I've been doing it for a while, and you guys listen to me on a regular basis, I tend to get a lot of questions from listeners about podcasting and how to do a podcast and things like that. So next question is from Clint, and I'll let him tell you what he's wondering about.
Hi, Adam. My name is Clint. I had a question about publishing a podcast. I'm putting together a podcast. I just finished my first one, and I plan on doing another one either today or tomorrow. And I just had a question about, once I finish this podcast, how do I get it submitted to like directories or somehow get it circulating through the gigantic podcast community? I know you mentioned something on one of your prior shows about it, and I just wanted a little bit more information on how to do that. Anyways, I wanted to say I love the show. Keep it up. It's great hearing all about the Apple stuff. So thanks. Bye.
Okay, so to answer Clint's question, the very first thing that you need to do is go over to iPodder.org, use their directory, and get your podcast listed in iPodder.org. It's really important because most of the podcatching clients that have built-in directories use the OPML feed from iPodder.org as the source for their information. So in order for you to be listed in the built-in directories on most podcatching clients like iPodderX or iPodder, you need to be in that directory. So start there. That's the very first place I would get listed. And then if you go over to podcastexpert.com, this is a new site. It's set up by the Podcast Brothers, who are just a really great resource for marketing and promotion of podcasts. They have a new site that is everything about podcasting, how to do a podcast, how to market it, how to get the word out there, the technical ins and outs. But they have a section on the website that is just directories. It lists the different podcast directories. And then I would just start there, and then you just need to go to each individual directory. And most of them have a form where you can submit your podcast to them to get listed. And you just need to one by one ask them to list your podcast. So it's the best way I know how to get it promoted. I'm sure it's going to change in, you know, coming months as more and more things happen, and we'll probably have a one source where you can go and just submit your podcast and get listed in all the directories, but that doesn't exist right now. So just right now you need to go one by one to each directory, but definitely start with iPodder.org's directory, because that's the one you want to get listed in first. And then probably podcastalley.com is another place you really want to get your site listed, and then just go through the list at podcastexpert.com. So good luck, Clint, and I hope that works out for you, and I hope your podcast takes off. So on Friday's show, we were playing with some AppleScript stuff. I had written an AppleScript based on a listener question a listener had written in and was wondering about a hotkey combination for starting the screensaver on his Macintosh. And I couldn't figure out a hotkey solution, but what I was able to figure out was that I could write an AppleScript that he could put in his dock that would actually launch the screensaver right out of the dock. And I called it Launch Saver, and I threw it out there and made it available to everybody, and but really couldn't find a way to activate that AppleScript with a hotkey. Well, listener Ben came to the rescue, and he found a program called Spark. There's a link to it in the show notes, and it allows you to do exactly that. It allows you to assign a hotkey that will actually launch an AppleScript application. So I thank him for that. And then also I had thrown out that we talked a little bit about i3, which is the new car interface for Macintosh. It allows you to install a Mac in your car and then provide a simple interface to it. But I was saying one of the problems with this interface was that it just basically launched the application. So you could assign a button and it would basically launch iTunes. But really what you wanted to have happen most likely is you push a button, it launches iTunes, starts playing some music, and in my case I gave the example of the Party Shuffle playlist, basically the playlist that just shuffles the songs in your iTunes library. So start playing a track from that playlist, and then, you know, maybe throw up something like the visualizer on your in-car LCD screen. And I thought, you know, that would be a cool AppleScript, and then you could just launch that from i3. Well, Ben actually went ahead and he put that together as well as an AppleScript and made it available. There's a link to that from the show notes. It's called Party Shuffler. So if you're interested in that, go ahead and pick it up. I also actually saw it on versiontracker.com. So Ben's actively, you know, promoting his new AppleScript application. So you might want to check that one out. Now, and real quickly before we move on, I want to give a little warning. Actually, this comes through our friend Axis Denai, and I should have made this caveat when I told you guys about the Launch Saver application that I wrote, the AppleScript I wrote. I am not an AppleScript programmer. I'm not very skilled at it, obviously, because Axis said he used my Launch Saver application and it actually locked up his G5 and he had to do a hard reboot. So I apologize to him for that, and I'll just caveat my application. Now, a lot of other listeners have been using it and it seems to work fine for them, so I'm not really sure what the specifics are, where the little bug in my code is, but I just wrote that quickly. It's definitely alpha. I didn't, you know, put it through any testing other than to run it on my iBook, and it ran fine. So use it at your own risk. You know, it may have problems, but I think it's working for most people. So if anybody else has had an issue with my little Launch Saver application, let me know, and maybe I'll look into it a little bit further. But if it's just a couple isolated cases, maybe somebody else wants to look at it and fix it for me, I'm not really sure. But anyway, just that little warning. So I'm discovering more and more, and I knew this already, and it's one of the great things I love about Macs and the people who use Macs, but we're a bunch of creative people. The other thing is we're also a bunch of very geeky people that sometimes have too much time on our hands. I got an email from a couple of Mac listeners who are heading on their spring break, Anthony and Arthur, and they decided that it would be really fun to go from Orange County, California, make a drive up to the Apple headquarters in Cupertino, one infinite loop, and go to this store there. They actually have a store there that you can visit and you can buy Mac products, basically things with Apple logos on them. They decided to drive all the way up there and just buy a single keychain and then drive back. So, you know, they're uber Mac geeks. You can email them at ocvideoguy@mac.com. That's ocvideoguy@mac.com. He said I could give out that email. They're planning on filming their little adventure, and I will update you when they get that little film posted. But if you want to email them and wish them encouragement or tell them they're crazy, whatever you want to do, they wanted me to let you guys know about it. And they're calling it The Journey to Apple's Core is what they're going to title their little mini movie. So look for that on a future MacCast, and just another example about how crazy Mac users and Mac geeks can sometimes be. Okay, I'm going to bring this up now. It's not going to be in the show notes, but this just happened to me again, and this is the second time. This happened on Friday as well. I mentioned a couple shows ago that, you know, suddenly my iBook has been acting up a little bit where after some usage, the fan will kick on and actually start making a lot of noise. I think the fan is normally on and the iBook is normally silent. I have an iBook G4 933. It's normally a very quiet machine, but all of a sudden, every once in a while, the fan will kick on. It makes a lot of noise. And then suddenly, the system will just lock. Actually, not the system. Specifically, GarageBand will lock up and crash on me. So I actually lose a little bit of my last recording, and it's getting a little bit frustrating. It happened on Friday, and it just happened again just now. So if anybody out there has a theory on what might be going on here, I'd love to hear about it. I'm stumped. It, you know, may just be that my system's due for an overhaul. I, you know, do a lot with it. I do the podcasts, and I've been moving a lot of data on and off of it, so it may just be time for house cleaning, maybe spring cleaning time in preparation for Tiger. So, but if anybody else has another theory, please let me know. So, at the top of the show, when we were talking about Camino, the new Camino website, I mentioned that I was going to talk about somebody who had some issues with browser performance or questions about browser performance. Jonathan was wondering about, and this is a question I get all the time from PC users who've switched over to the Macintosh, comes up over and over again, and they basically claim that their PC browser is faster than their Macintosh browser. And it can be whatever browser you want. So it could be IE on the PC versus IE on the Mac, or Firefox on the PC versus Firefox on the Mac. There's a general conception that browsers on the PC either are more responsive or render more quickly. And, you know, I'm not really sure why this is. One of my theories is it's sort of like the megahertz myth between Macs and PCs, or even between like Intel and AMD processors. It's that, you know, depending on how your system's configured, which system you have, which browsers you're running, how much memory you have, things like that, there's all these factors that go in and can skew results one way or the other. So I think when you go out online and you look at, you know, browser comparisons, anybody can kind of tweak their numbers to make one system look better than the other. That's just one of my theories. Another thing I think that is that specifically with IE on the PC, because it's integrated so tightly into the operating system, I think there's some things they're able to do to optimize their browser performance that maybe you're not able to do when you have a browser just sitting on top of the operating system. But if anybody has some tips on optimizing your browser for the Macintosh, basically optimizing Safari or Firefox or Camino for that matter, please send me an email, let me know, and I'll get it passed on to Jonathan. I'd love to know myself. And then also, if anybody has some theories or some can shed some light on why there's this conception that PC browsers are faster than Mac browsers, I'd certainly love to hear that as well. So just let me know. So I've talked a lot on the show about AppleCare and my firm belief that if you're buying hardware, specifically a laptop, you really should invest in Apple's AppleCare program to extend the warranty on your Macintosh for another 2 years beyond the default 1-year warranty that Apple provides for you. And my main theory on PowerBooks and iBooks is the LCD screens. If you ever have a problem with that, those are very expensive to replace. So it's nice to have AppleCare in place just to cover you. And I have a listener, Cody, who I've been talking with back and forth for a while. He's a high school student, and he lives in Florida. And he really, really wants an iBook. I think he's a PC user right now. And he wants an iBook. He's trying to convince his parents, or he's got the money saved up, basically, I think $1,300 saved up to buy an iBook. And he basically needs to get the educational pricing. I actually might be confusing Cody with another listener. I actually have a couple listeners who are PC switchers that are talking to me. But anyway, Cody has some money saved up. He's been working really hard. Sounds like a really great kid. And he really needs to get educational pricing from Apple. Apparently, he's having a hard time finding it in his area. I believe that if you have an Apple store in your area, you go in and show them your student ID, they'll honor the educational pricing. But you can also go online and order it from Apple. Apple has a special area. If you go to store.apple.com, look down towards the bottom and you'll see educational pricing. You can actually look up your school, even K through 12. And if your school is listed, you're able to get educational pricing from Apple, which is a little bit cheaper. But the other shocking thing that Cody told me is he had gone in and they told him that he could not get AppleCare because he lived in Florida. And I was a little puzzled by this and wasn't something I was really aware of. Living in California, I guess you just don't know about these things. But I went onto Apple's website to look at their AppleCare program, and sure enough, down at the bottom in small type, it says, "This plan is not available for Florida and Wyoming consumers or where prohibited by law." And so if anybody in Florida or Wyoming can email me and tell me specifically why, Apple doesn't go into details. I'm assuming this is one of those strange law things that we have in different states, but it seems ridiculous that you can't get warranty protection in Florida or Wyoming. So I'm a little bit curious about that. And maybe somebody can shed some light on it. Or maybe it's a fact, maybe it's an opposite effect. And I didn't even think about this till just now, but maybe you are 100% covered for a longer period in Florida or Wyoming, or maybe for life. So, you know, some states actually have better consumer protection laws than others, so maybe you just don't even need AppleCare in those states. I don't know. Anyway, if anybody can shed some light, send me an audio comment or feedback, and I'd love to know about why that is. Okay, finally tonight, I want to thank a bunch of people. I mentioned a couple shows ago about different ways that you can support the MacCast, and one of those is to go to MacCast.com, and I have a PayPal link where you can actually just make a straight donation to the MacCast. And I have had some very generous listeners send me donations, and it's really going to go a long way to help keeping the show going. Specifically, there's one person I really want to thank. I got a very generous donation from Chip. So Chip, thank you very much. You know what that meant to me, and I sent you an email, but I just wanted to thank you on air. In addition, I want to just run down a quick list of names of people who have donated to the show. I think I'm going to plan on, in the future, putting up a donors list, and I'll probably be contacting everybody who's donated so far to get their permission to use their name on the MacCast.com website. But anyway, I want to say thank you to Elizabeth, Randy, Lauren, Emmanuel, Evelyn, Brian, Adam, Antonio, David, Anthony, Ryan, and Gerald. All of you, your donations were received and greatly appreciated. It's going to help keep the show running, help me pay for my bandwidth and hosting costs, as well as ongoing promotion and things like that for the MacCast. If I forgot anybody else, I'm sorry I didn't mention your name specifically, but thank you to everybody who's done that. All right, that's the show for tonight. It's a kind of listener feedback heavy. Hopefully, we'll be getting some more news showing up here after Apple Tiger's released. I'm sure it's going to be a long flood for a while. Hopefully that'll last us off into the summer until maybe we get some new Mac models. As always, there's lots of ways to provide feedback to the show. Visit the website, maccast.com. You can now just leave comments right on the maccast.com website. Use the comments for the specific show and leave any feedback there. You can send me email, maccast@gmail.com. MP3 audio comments are greatly appreciated, but you can also just leave text emails for me. And then also call the feedback hotline, 206-222-2788. That's 20-MACCAST-8. And Then, you know, lastly, I want to mention again that there is a couple new ways to support the show in addition to the donations that I mentioned, which, you know, are always greatly appreciated. But if you just are a person who shops on Amazon.com, something you can do that would really help me out is just go to shop.maccast.com. I have a bunch of products there that I'm featuring that are products that I use and am very happy with. I don't get any money from the manufacturers of those products. They're just straight products that I like and I enjoy, and I'm, you know, letting you know about them. But even if you're not going to buy one of those products, even if you're just going to go on Amazon.com, you know you're going to go on Amazon.com and buy something. If you go to shop.maccast.com first, click on one of those Amazon links, and then buy what you want to buy on Amazon, I get a small percentage of the sale for being an Amazon affiliate. So if you can do that, that will help me support the show as well financially, and it'll help me keep me from having to, you know, take on advertisers or do some sort of subscription thing, which I really don't want to do. I don't really want to commercialize the show because I think it somewhat hampers the integrity or just the perception of the integrity of the show. So I don't want to do that. I also just recently added iTunes affiliate program. So there's some iTunes music there that I recently bought some albums that I like and I thought I'd share with you guys. But again, there as well, if you just are planning on buying a track on iTunes, if you go through shop.maccast.com first, click on one of the iTunes links, and then just browse and buy whatever tracks you or albums you want, I will still get a small percentage of the sale, and that will help support the show. Finally tonight, I had thrown out a request for MacCast listeners to provide me audio to use at the closing of the show. At the closing of the show, I feature a new artist, a new independent artist that is RIAA free music or music that I have permission to play. And you guys responded greatly. I've received 3 tracks already, so the next 3 shows are lined up with MacCast listener music. And tonight's no exception. I have a song from Samantha Murphy. You can visit her at samanthamurphy.com. The track is called Come Back to You. If you like it, please visit her website and buy her CD. She'll really appreciate it. Thanks again to everybody for those great donations, for the great emails. Keep them coming. That's the show for tonight, and I will see you all next time. Ooh.
to you.